Side two of tape number 377, February 22nd, 1979. A lawsuit was filed the end of January of 79, but I didn't get information about it until just last week in Las Vegas, Nevada, by the family of Howard Hughes, the former czar of the Howard Hughes financial empire. The czars have been accused in a lawsuit of beguiling the industrials and taking advantage of his drug addiction to drain off $50 million for self-serving schemes. The defendants in the case are former president of Summa Corporation Frank William Gay, New York attorney Chester Davis, seven personal aides to Howard Hughes. Those are Kay Glenn, Livar Mylar, John Holmes, Clarence Waldron, Howard Eckersley, James Ricard, George Frankham, Doctors Wilbur Thane, Dr. Homer Clark, and Dr. Norman Crane. The family said that they drugged Howard Hughes. They destroyed records that were in his possession on his deathbed. They controlled his communications. They were negligent in his medical care. And that even though a federal grand jury had indicted one of the aides and two doctors of illegally supplying him with painkilling drugs, this just scratches the surface. There's a Las Vegas attorney, Samuel Lionel, on behalf of the First National Bank in Nevada and William Loomis and the Summa Corporation, that is suing these persons. They said at least $50 million was siphoned from Summa Corporation through a series of self-serving schemes they used to support and educate certain children of the defendants, pardon me, and furnish and maintain private homes. They maintained their own personal expenses and funneled it into inflated employment and consulting contracts, outside consulting contracts. And the Hughes estate is demanding full restitution with interest. They filed this in Las Vegas. Now, I called this particular attorney who's filing the suit for the family, and I told him about my research. I called Samuel Lionel this week and told him about the research and asked him if he would help with a project that I've had to exhume Howard Hughes, that I believe that this Vance Cooper is in his grave, and that part of their problem was that the reason they could drug this man and take his money and leave these broken needles in his body and board up the window with curtains and take a hotel room with a floor below that they also owned, hotels owned by Daniel Ludwig, another mysterious billionaire. The reason they could do all that was that they substituted Howard a long time ago. Well, Mr. Lionel didn't agree with me. He said he didn't agree that Howard wasn't in London or Nicaragua or made the telephone conversation that was videotaped from the Bahamas. He said, we have all these memos, and Howard wrote them. But yet, when Clifford Irving had these memos and wrote his book on Howard Hughes that finally went to court as a hoax, Mr. Osborne and the world's most famous handwriting experts said that those were Howard Hughes' handwriting. And it was later revealed that it was a hoax, but the handwriting experts from the publishers and Time and Life published parts and excerpts of the Clifford Irving book had said that it was Hughes. So if they were fooled, why would these particular people believe that it was Howard? I mentioned to the attorney my correspondence with Clarence Kelly on fingerprinting the body and the discrepancies in how he wouldn't name the agents who identified the body. And the thing that interested him that he wanted information about was when I told him that my correspondence with FBI Director Clarence Kelly was stolen from my home. The Justice Department replaced it when I asked them for copies. They replaced it with the correspondence that Mr. Kelly dictated to me before he signed his name. Another thing that interested him mildly was the suggestion that Brooks Randall on national television, Good Morning America, had said that Vance Cooper was buried in Howard's grave, and he said, well, Randall just wanted publicity. I said, well, what did he get out of it? He said, well, wasn't he on television? I said, for 1 minute he was on, but if you exhumed the body and it wasn't Howard, you would find even more chicanery if you went farther. He wasn't too anxious to get into that aspect, but I think the story of what happened to Howard Hughes is terribly important, because when people like Nelson Rockefeller and Howard Hughes die off like just common dogs, then you have a little inkling of what's going to happen to you in the future. When they use drugs and secrecy on such famous people that are known to everybody and could have security guards around them, then you have absolutely no protection any more than the Jewish tailor that was taken into Buchenwald or Dachau or Auschwitz. Your future is lined up in the direct proportion with which you care about who killed your public leaders or who killed anybody in this country, who injects Martha Mitchell. See, that's an important thing, that even though I don't agree with Martha politically, if they can give her an injection, which 3 years later causes an unusual cancer, which you can predict to the day just about that she will have a fatal disease based upon the fact that she got that injection, a famous injection in California again at a hospital where Herbert Kalmbach took her to a hospital and used a name as his own wife passed her off and didn't use the name Martha Mitchell. When these people can get away with this at the highest level with the media watching everything they do, it's a little bit warning about what they're going to do to all the others when the time comes, and that's why it's so important to expose every injustice, no matter who it comes upon. And the way they treated Howard is indicative of what they think about people in general. And dealing directly with that subject, there was an article in Newsweek this last week, dated February the 19th, 1979, page 36, on investments, the diamond scam. And it's about a company called De Beers Diamonds Limited, with South African connotations, making you think that it has to do with South African diamond mines. But it's a diamond scam called Diamond Resources Corporation out of Manhattan that had former FBI persons on the account that worked for them. And they said, this article says that Donald Nixon, nephew of the former president, made several $50,000 telephone sales for this diamond firm. Nixon's attorney denies that his client was connected with the firm, but he did call some of his friends to see if they wanted to purchase these diamonds. By most accounts, De Beers ran the slickest scam before it collapsed last fall. It netted $100 million from 15,000 investors in 4 years of operation. Two retired FBI agents were on the staff, and the brochures warned customers to beware of hucksters in the industry. The investigators said De Beers was run by Harold McClintock, a sometimes FBI informant who was convicted in 1967 of defrauding the disabled American veterans of $2 million. Authorities also linked De Beers salesmen with past Arizona land fraud schemes. I've done several tapes on the gemstone files of Richard Nixon and the allegations of Bruce Roberts of dealing in gemstones. And of course, we know Richard Nixon's career was very closely associated with the Howard Hughes organization from 1946. I've mentioned this on other past tapes to his introduction to Howard Hughes, the Beverly Hills Hotel, when he was still just out of the Navy to run against Congressman Voorhees, again, out here in California. And the gemstone file may have a lot to do in 1972 with the organizations that were being set up in Arizona. But there are two books out on Don Bowles, the reporter that was killed in Arizona, and I'm going to give you the printed titles of those: Don Bowles, An Investigation into His Murder by Martin Talberg, and The Arizona Project by Michael Wendland. And in the one book, The Arizona Project, there were a team of investigative reporters that went out to Arizona to find out how Don Bowles, the reporter, was murdered. But the important thing about this diamond mine expedition, that it was linked, it says, also to Arizona land fraud schemes. The one book has, The Arizona Project, has a chapter on the Goldwater Ranch, the friends of Barry and Robert Goldwater. They have a picture of Senator Barry Goldwater, the man who says we're ready for the next war, and his brother Robert, and their business ties to a man named Harry Rosenzweig. Very terrible-looking characters. There's photographs of them in the one book. But in the book Don Bowles by Martin Tolberg, there's a section about Donald Harris, an ex-Marine Corps officer who became the county attorney to fight organized crime in the Phoenix area. Scottsdale is right outside of the Phoenix area, and Scottsdale is where this office was for this mining scam that Richard Nixon's brother was working for. Scottsdale, Arizona, was their office. And in this one book, Mr. Harris was addressing members of the Scottsdale Bar Association about the Phoenix area as being a haven for gangsters and criminals with ties to civic leaders and public officials. And he said they're so strong that eradication of organized crime is nearly impossible. He told the Scottsboro Bar Association that since he took office that he got his first death threat, and he was told in the death threat, "We should have killed you instead of Don Bowles." Mr. Harris went on to say that he took on the two powerful newspapers in the area, the Republic and Gazette, which are newspaper combined, and he asserted that President Richard Nixon, in 1972 personally placed a telephone call to the Arizona Republic asking that a criminal investigation of a national leader by reporter Don Bowles be called off. And according to Harris, he said that the files on this particular case then disappeared from the county attorney's office so that there was not now enough evidence to prosecute the case. I was doing an article on the murder of Don Bowles, which is totally different than these two books. And it goes into the Howard Hughes organization and the use of an office in Flagstaff, Arizona, and a land fraud scheme that had to do with Howard Hughes' aides, Livar Marlar and Howard Eckersley, who are now defendants in this lawsuit that has been filed in Las Vegas, Nevada, for scamming millions of dollars. And what these two men did in 1972, they went up to the Montreal Stock Exchange and put on some phony land fraud sales and made millions of dollars off of that using a prospectus with Howard Hughes' name in the Bahamas. Now, when Howard Hughes was alive, he would never allow his name to be used for anything like that. And the article that I wrote for Playgirl it was published in 1974, is Howard Hughes Dead and Buried Off a Greek Island, claimed that he had been dead since 1971. And in 1972, these men left Arizona and went up to make millions of dollars off the Montreal Stock Market Exchange on land frauds in Arizona. And Howard Hughes, of course, couldn't complain. I don't think he existed at that point. I disagree with this particular attorney. And that's how they could get away with those land frauds. And when Don Bowles died, he had the word Emprise on his name, on his lips, which involved the men in the Buffalo Organized Crime Syndicate and Mo Dalitz in California, and also linked the assassination teams. And I think the reason that Don Bowles died at that time was that he was on to something, because the land frauds had to do with Howard Hughes, Richard Nixon's brother, possibly C. Arnold Smith. They were linked out there. And again, the gemstone papers, the fraudulent diamond deal could have been cooking up at that time. It certainly escalated later, and it's just been exposed now, the diamond deal. But these men had millions of dollars to play around with scams. The Hughes aides had millions of dollars to play around with scams. They could take this lawsuit said $50 million off the top and use it for their own education, their own money, but they could take just several thousand dollars and set up offices and produce very little, give very little, close up, go into bankruptcy, go into hiding, and then take off another few hundred million or whatever it is they needed. And they can keep compounding the thievery and close shop and run. I don't know what will result from this charge against these aides. I hope it goes to the very top. Again, because Howard Hughes was a cover for national security, they'll use the excuse like they did last week in the ITT case and throw out the case. If you saw articles in 1975 on up, continuously ever since Watergate, there was one in the Los Angeles Times, Hughes Empire suited to be front for the CIA. Now, when the Hughes Empire is the front for the CIA, whether it's mind control or submarines or whatever, Then they say national security, so that it's very hard to find out what these men were doing, because they may say, we didn't use it for our own sake, it was reinvested for the government, and we've put it somewhere else for national security. But I think it's interesting now that Newsweek has an article about this diamond scam. Imagine using the name of the South African diamond mines, De Beers, getting away even using the name, using FBI agents, two retired FBI agents on the staff, who are warning, stay away from hucksters, and they themselves are part of the huckster team ripping people off, and using Donald Nixon, coming out of Scottsdale, involved in Arizona land fraud schemes, and then going back to the Don Bowles book and saying that this particular investigator was warned by President Nixon personally himself, call off the Don Bowles investigation. Because if you ever got into that the right way, not the way these 20 reporters did that went down there, but the really right way, again, we'd be in the bowels of the things that make America and the things that make warfare states. You see, Mr. Barry Goldwater he'll vote war across the board. His ilk will vote war. The Hughes Company, the satellites, the aircraft, the spy planes, the warships, the helicopters, like war. Remember the memo of Howard Hughes during the Vietnam War, keep the war going 2 more years, it's good for the helicopter business. That's why you're going to wage war in Russia against Russia. It's simply dollars and cents. It's what Alger Hiss was talking about in the 30s before the Senate when he brought the book, he didn't write, The Merchants of Death, to the Senate and showed that the arms manufacturers are making arms for both sides, and they sit back and watch them kill each other and make millions of dollars and then send in weapons when it's over and start all over again. Barry Goldwater warned you about war. These men vote war, they make war, and that's the link of the aerospace industry and the U.S. Empire, the war makers, to these sleazy little land schemes and so forth. They can get away with their schemes as long as their politicians are paid off and the politicians vote yes on the armaments. It's a vicious cycle of organized crime and warfare industries scratching each other's back and making profits off of the people who keep poor and diseased and sit down like a bunch of mild little sheep and take it. Just at the time of the elections in Italy when they wanted to get out the communists or the leftists, Aldo Moro was murdered, and the Red Brigade was charged with killing Aldo Moro, and I had mentioned way back, I don't even remember which tape, the opposition that Moro had against the Vatican, and that he could be silenced, and they could use the Reds to murder him to make it look like the vicious Reds have killed a public official, and they get rid of an opponent of the Vatican at the same time, and they scare people to vote the right wing in. These election murders escalate just at the time of election, so several purposes are served at one time. You get rid of one good public servant, you spread fear of the left, and you vote in the right. It's a double whammy from all sides. There's an article this week that a man who said he was a Red Brigade defector could lead police to the killer of former Premier Aldo Moro. And he was charged with trying to swindle the Italian government. He was arrested. Pasquale Frezza, 44, was apprehended. And he had offered to identify the Red Brigade's leaders in return for money and protection. There's an Italian magazine, L'Espresso, that said that this defector was telling people in a meeting last month about Moro's murder and that the former Italian premier's kidnap slaying was organized by two unidentified members of the parliament and a person linked to the Vatican. That was in the papers this week in most of the wire services, that the Aldo Moro murder was linked to the Vatican. So I go back and remind you of this marvelous book by George Seldes, Never Tire of Protesting, and he describes the conflict of the Vatican's holdings, which were between $10 and $15 billion in 1965. This was a calculated guess, and Aldo Moro believed that the Vatican should itemize their stocks and bonds. In this book, it says the Democratic Party tried to slip through a law exempting the Vatican and legalizing the Concordat the present republic does not honor. Premier Aldo Moro, the Italian Premier Aldo Moro, was jockeyed by the socialist into demanding from the Vatican an itemized statement of its stocks and bonds. He did not get it. However, the possibility of the Vatican dumping $900 billion worth of stock on the market and causing a panic and ruining Oldermuro was always present, and as a result, nothing was done to exact the tax. He felt that the Catholic Church had so many businesses, railroads and steamships, and they were linked to the ITT telephone company, buildings in Madrid, skyscrapers, the Watergate Hotel they had built, and they have holdings in so many corporations. But the Italian premier thought that the Vatican should itemize their particular holdings as a huge multi-billion dollar industry. And he lost that fight. And now it comes out in February of 1979 that the murderers of Oldermuro are linked to the Vatican. And it comes as no surprise. I heard that a long time ago, and it's becoming more public now, and people are becoming a little more aware to search. It isn't off limits to say the Vatican could kill one pope to put another pope in. It's right out in the headline now, did the nun poison the last pope? There's this kind of awareness, and I think as people get afraid of what the future brings, they'll get more daring in what they've been thinking and are afraid to say among their friends and relatives. I was growing up, and many of you are probably around the same age that I am, and then many of these listeners are much younger, a whole different generation. We were taught there were two things you never talked about. One was religion and one was politics. You went to family parties, dinner parties, meetings. Those were off limits. Don't talk about politics or religion. And it's perfectly obvious that that was one of the conspiracies. You don't have to read David Mark's book on the Manchurian Candidate to know mind control. In those days, we were so stupid, we obeyed. You didn't bring these things up. And I know many people who take these tapes who are closet listeners. They sit in there and put on their little tapes and put their earplugs in, and so the mate can't listen or doesn't want to hear it, or the family, or they just listen all alone, and they go out in the world and they have friends. They don't bring up the subject. They're afraid they'll offend somebody. They're afraid the friend will think they're paranoid. They're afraid that somebody will think they're crazy. And I just don't understand it. I mean, when you're not afraid of being called crazy or paranoid or stupid or off on some tangent, when you're not afraid of it, when you speak what you think or fear, you'll find that other people think or fear the same thing. And if you're not in company who think that way, change your company, because these people are digging your grave. Some people think if you take a boat across the Atlantic, you'll make it. And there's other people that are drilling holes in it and think it's fun because they have their hands on the lifeboat. And you're going to sink. If you don't have your hand on the lifeboat, you're going to sink. And you have to speak out. So today, the Associated Press can talk about links to the Vatican with Oldermuro, where 5-10 years ago, they couldn't possibly do it. Maybe they did it, but I wasn't aware of it then. And I think it's good now that people are coming forward and expressing these links and looking for them. At least some people are. Last week, there was a guilty verdict in the Saul Mineo murder in Los Angeles. A man named Lionel Williams, a former pizza delivery man, was found guilty of a stabbing death in 1976. Saul Mineo was murdered. Associated Press story has it that the Los Angeles Superior Court, after 7 days of deliberation, decided that Lionel Williams was guilty, and he faces 15 years to life for this. There were witnesses to the murder of Saul Mineo, and the witnesses said that he was white. There were three witnesses who saw the murder, and they said it was a white man. And these people said that the man who ran away was about 5'8" or taller, and Mr. Williams is 5'5". But the prosecutor argued that it was too dark in the alley to determine the skin or the height of the killer, and he asked the jury to consider the evidence against Williams. The Associated Press article that I have says that Mineo was nominated for the Academy Award for Rebel Without a Cause and the movie Exodus, and was returning from rehearsing a play when he was stabbed to death. That's the Associated Press story, if you got it. But what they didn't say was he was doing a play on Sirhan Sirhan, that he was playing the role of Sirhan Sirhan when he was stabbed to death. And that puts it in a different ball game, because one picture is worth 1,000 words. And various researchers like Bill Turner, Don Fried, Ted Chirac, And Bill Christian had been working on this play, and it was going to be a good play to be produced in Los Angeles and made into a movie. And Saul Mineo was murdered just when they were in preparation for making the movie. Greg Roberts, again, he wrote an article, I quoted him on the other side of this tape, on the Rockefeller story. Greg Roberts wrote a story for the Hollywood Press, Saul Mineo's Killers, Probably Still at Large. And this is his version, not the Associated Press version. The trial of Lionel Williams, a 22-year-old black ex-convict who once allegedly bragged of having stabbed and killed the late Saul Mineo and was sent from Michigan to California. The trial ended last week. Mineo was brutally killed February the 12th, 1976, in front of his West Hollywood apartment. He was considering playing the role of Sirhan Sirhan in a long-since-abandoned film, which was to feature Mineo in the role of Sirhan as an RFK assassination patsy and fall guy. Mineo was interested in the RFK assassination probe. He had worked with Don Freed, Jack Kimbrough, Ted Chirac, William Turner, and John Christian, not William Christian, John Christian. Turner, an ex-FBI agent who, unlike L.A. County Sheriff Peter Pitches, had a fallout with FBI Director Hoover. He protested Hoover's methods, and he was working with Christian, the men that got out the book, The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. The book describes the paramilitary right wing, former LAPD officers, high-ranking L.A. city officials, organized crime figures, and elements of the Central Intelligence Agency as having left Sirhan behind at the scene of the June 5, 1968 assassination, making him, like Oswald, the lone assassin. Now, the thing that I object to Bill Turner's book and John Christian's book is that they don't go farther into the modalities, connections, the Howard Hughes. Grant Cooper was the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, and he had just come off from a case with John Rosselli. That was his client of organized crime who worked with Robert Mayhew and the assassination teams. And they didn't go into the background of Sirhan as an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency linked to the Greek Orthodox Church in that conduit. I object to the book because they don't make those giant links that I have to the Hughes connections to the assassination, the Howard Hughes connections to this assassination of Robert Kennedy. But their book does go into the paramilitary right and organized crime. The murder of Saul Mineo was undoubtedly intended as a message for other Hollywood movie stars and celebrities not to rock the boat on the RFK cover-up, which includes the L.A. Police Department Special Unit, which investigated the case. The Special Unit Senator was set up by the LAPD and then became the Criminal Conspiracy Section in Los Angeles that Lewis Tackwood worked under, and Donald DeFries. The Special Unit Senator was a book written on the Robert Kennedy assassination done by the police department that had been involved in the assassination. Greg Roberts said, if nothing else, one does not realistically expect the L.A. Sheriff's homicide would ever attempt to apprehend Saul Mineo's real killer if they were connected with right-wing mafia CIA. And the article goes on to say that during the Williams trial, Elliot Mintz testified that he was Saul Mineo's best friend and that Mineo was interested in the JFK assassinations. And Mintz said that he learned a lot with Saul Mineo. They exchanged information on the various assassinations and that he was stimulated to ascertain the truth into Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy's assassination. And that's what he was working on. And he thought that it would open his mind to play the real role that Sirhan Sirhan played in the RFK assassination. At the trial, Mintz played a once secretly recorded tape he made in 1977 along with his daughter that contended that a particular woman had seen the Mineo murder suspect leaving the murder scene. Mrs. DeCessa contacted Mr. Mintz on a public appeal about the unsolved Mineo killing. The girl had not actually seen the face or skin, but they believed that this fleeing suspect was a white man, as did other witnesses at the time, and Mr. Mintz had testified on behalf of Williams at the trial. But the district attorney's office and the L.A. sheriff's office have taken Mr. Lionel Williams, 22 years old, and charged him with the murder of Saul Mineo. And Greg Roberts has a lead story in the Hollywood Press, February the 9th, Saul Mineo's Killers, Probably Still at Large. There was a plane crash, Mount Baldy Village, this week. Three people died. 11-year-old boy survived. The man who died in the plane crash, the father of the boy, was a former FBI official who wrote the book in 1967, Inside the FBI. He was given $10,000 in a Freedom of Information suit in November of 78 because he said the FBI was on his back and was surreptitiously bothering and trying to get him fired. They were interfering with his personal life and his future employment after he left the FBI. He received $10,000 in November, and he died in a plane crash in February, just 3 months later. He was critical of the agency. He had settled his suit, and he promised to purge his file of any improperly kept